the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Today's guest on the program is Patrick Flynn. We're going to be talking about the Affordable Care Act, known in its nickname form as Obamacare. What about people who have lost insurance, whose insurance premiums are higher, small, big businesses? They're all trying to cope in one way or another with the Affordable Care Act. What do you do if you're being affected by this, and how do you find the proper insurance that you need at a rate that is affordable? That will be the subject today later on in the program.
But on today's show, we're going to talk about numbers. Now, relax. We're not going to be doing a lot of math. This is, after all, a podcast. It's not a classroom. But what I want to do is, you know, we've talked about knowing a number when you get to retirement. But there's really several type of numbers that you need leading up to retirement. For example, and I'm going to break it down and make it easy. Number one, what is your marginal tax bracket? Folks, it makes a big difference when you're saving for retirement if you can cut down on the amount of taxes that you pay on your investments, because those investments are taxed at your highest bracket. So we'll be talking about the first number you need to know is your marginal tax bracket if you're saving for retirement. Number two, what is your budget for retirement? Because everybody says, well, you need to know your number. Your number depends on what your expenses are going to be. And I guarantee you, your expenses in retirement are going to look a whole lot different than what they are raising a family or working. Number three is, what is the amount of money that you're going to need to make retirement happen? And number four, and this is one that most people don't think about, the three different phases of retirement. Phase one could be somebody that retires early, before age 59 and a half, when they can tap into pension funds, or 5 or 6 years prior to retirement. What are the things that you need to get in place so when that day comes, whether it's a decision you make on your own, or it's a decision that's made for you with maybe downsizing, that you know that's what we call phase one, because there are a lot of things you don't have access to during that phase one process. Phase two is usually when you get to at least 59 and a half, you can tap into pension funds without penalties or having to annuitize. And usually phase three is age 66 and after, when you get full retirement benefits from Social Security. Now, knowing these numbers may determine, number one, if you're going to be able to retire. Two, when will you be able to retire? Three, whether you stay and remain retired. There are a lot of retirees right now, because of low interest rates or bad investments, are finding themselves they have to go back to work. And number four, go broke. Yes, we're seeing some people. In fact, we're seeing a lot of situations today where parents are moving in with their kids because they simply don't have the money.
Wow, you've got my attention now. This is becoming interesting. Kids are still living with their parents, parents moving back in with their kids. This could be a little house on the prairie all over again, you know?
Welcome to the new dynamics of financial repression, because that's exactly what we're seeing, John.
Yeah, maybe you should call it the dynamics, because I don't think anybody wants to think of dying broke. You know, as you said, this is not a lot of math. But that was a lot of numbers that went roaring by here. So let's see if we can make some sense of this for people and then put it all together. It's not as bad as it seems. You just have to lay it out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like a roadmap. You're at point A and you want to go up to point B. Let's say I'm in San Diego. I want to drive up to San Francisco. I'm going to look at a map and there are certain highways I'm going to have to get on to make my trip happen. And it's the same premise. When you start with, let's say you're not retired, so what are you doing? You are saving up and putting money aside, hopefully, so you will be able to retire. In the first number, as I talked about, there are four numbers that you need to know, is your marginal tax bracket. Now, for those of you that have filed your tax return, I'm going to give you a simple line item. Go to the back page of the first page of your tax return. It's called taxable income. It's actually line number 43 on your tax number. When you get that number, that is your taxable income. You can go to the tax tables and it's going to tell you what marginal tax bracket you're in. And the reason you need to know that number, Because what that's telling you is if you make one more dollar of interest, one more dollar of salary, it's going to tell you at what rate that new dollar will be taxed at. And for those of you that are saving for retirement, what you want to do is minimize your taxes on your investments, because the top tax rate today, depending on what your level of income, is 44% at the federal level. By the time you add the Clinton tax rates, the phase out of deductions with the Pease Amendment, and then you add Obamacare taxes, you can get up to 44%. And here in California, add another 13, you're talking 57%. You do not want to have your investment income taxed at 57%. It's going to take you that much longer to get the money that you want to retire. So if you can do your savings or investing in a tax-efficient manner, the more taxes that you save, the more dollars you have in your pocket that are accumulating for retirement.
So if we're talking about efficient saving for retirement, obviously we have discussed on our weekend program, Financial Sense NewsHour, the fact that we've been in a zero interest rate environment, which means certain types of savings are very difficult to get anything on. You have to be able to save efficiently and also in an efficient tax environment, so what you're saving doesn't get wiped out by the taxes. So how do you minimize the taxes when putting away dollars?
Well, I mean, for most of our listeners, they're probably employees, either in the private sector or the public sector. And if you're putting money away, the most efficient way to do it is to put money in your employer pension plan. Maybe it's a 401k if you're in a public company. In the private sector, in the public sector, it might be a 403b or let's say a 457 plan. Because number one, the money that you put into that 401k, it's a tax deduction right off the top. It reduces your gross income. And effectively, let's say you're in a 40% bracket and you put $10,000 in a 401k program. Essentially, you're saving $4,000. So of that $10,000, really, the government's contributing $4,000, the amount that you would pay the government if you didn't put that money in a pension plan. So you get a tax deduction off the top. Secondly, any earnings, whether interest or dividends or capital gains on that investment, are tax deferred until you start to draw them out when you retire. And in many corporations, you get matching contributions. You get 100% contribution. I know many companies that match, I think, the first 6% you put of your pay into a 401k program, they're going to match it dollar for dollar. So that's like getting 100% return on every new dollar that you put into your pension plan the first year. So there are a number of reasons why this is probably one of the most efficient things you can do when saving for retirement.
Well, under those terms, then, using a pension plan seems fairly obvious. Most Americans are using either like a 401k, a 403b, 454 plans. But what about outside pension plans? Is there anything that you could invest in that might be, say, for example, tax-free, tax-deferred, or tax-sheltered for that matter?
Yeah, my favorites in terms of investing outside of a pension plan are tax-sheltered, tax-deferral, and lower taxation. I mean, real estate, you can't get excess deductions to offset your regular income, but you can have the income or rents that you receive from real estate, you can have them partially sheltered through depreciation and expenses. There are stocks, or what we know as master limited partnerships or royalty trust, where you can get 5 to 7 returns and have maybe anywhere from 60 to 70% of those dividends sheltered. I also like dividends. This is something that, you know, a lot of people have stayed away from the stock market, but folks, you know, if you're in the Bush tax bracket, your dividends are taxed at 15% versus the average individual who's probably in a 30% bracket or as high as 44%. And if you have your own private business and you're a C corporation, if you invest in high dividend paying stocks, almost 80% of those dividends, or I think it's 70%, is exempt from federal taxes. So you need to think like Warren Buffett. I mean, everybody knows Buffett is a very shrewd and smart stock picker, but he's probably one of the shrewdest businessmen I know when it comes to paying taxes. He keeps all of his income at a 20% tax bracket. That's why Buffett has amassed a large amount of capital. Berkshire Hathaway is his own personal tax shelter. And I want to illustrate a point. Let's say that you have $10,000 a year of investment income coming in from your investments. If you're in a 40% bracket, you're paying out of that $10,000, $4,000 in taxes, Or if you're in a 20% bracket, you're only paying $2,000 out of that $10,000. Now, you may not think that's much, but let's say you're reinvesting that $10,000 after tax. Well, if you're in a 40% bracket over 10 years, if you're putting in $6,000 a year, which is what you would have after taxes, it would grow to about $128,000 in 20 years, and then $95,000 in 10 years. You take a look at if you were doing it in a 20% bracket, meaning you were saving $8,000 because you paid half the amount of taxes, you would have $458,000 in 20 years versus what you would have in another bracket. So it makes a major, major difference if you can cut down on the amount of taxes that you're paying on your investments. It's plain and simple. It's more money in your pocket. It's more money that you're going to invest.
So you can see a significant difference if you want to minimize your taxes. Warren Buffett's strategy was to keep investments taxed at lower brackets and rates. Let's move on to the second number, a retirement budget. And this may become a fluid thing. You have to plan it today, but understand that there will be changes in the future, some of which you can possibly anticipate as you're planning today, others possibly not.
Yeah, because this really drives the investment number when people say, well, how much dollars will I need saved up by the time I retire? A lot of that, folks, is going to depend on what your budget is. And you need to sit down and take a look at where you're spending money now. Maybe you have a house payment. Maybe when you retire, you will pay cash for a home. You downsize, you move to another state where there's no income taxes. I know a lot of people on the East Coast move down to Florida where there's no income taxes, or even Texas. And, you know, they sell the big home that they raise the family in. They take some of that equity. They pay cash for a smaller home. So their budget is going to look much different when they retire. They may not have to have updated cars. Maybe they get down to one car. They're going to be doing more traveling. They're going to have more time for leisure. So when you think about retirement, you need to really think of, you know, what is it going to cost me to live when I'm retired? You don't want to retire and then have to discover this. And this is the number that drives another number, which is how much do I need to have in assets when I retire to provide the income I'm going to need to provide me throughout retirement. And remember, the expenses are different. You're going to live differently. Most people will end up living in a smaller home. Many people will end up living in a different state. There's different tax consequences. There's different estate tax consequences. But mainly, take a look at what the living expenses are going to be. They're probably going to be cheaper in Florida than they are in New York or New Jersey. And you have to think this through because it really tells you what your next number is. And if you don't know what your living expenses are going to be in retirement, then how are you really going to know how much money you're going to have saved up to get you to retirement so you will feel comfortable and not have to end up going back to work or end up going broke later on in your retirement years, which is something we're seeing more and more people do.
So we're on the way to planning a budget, which you have to come up with. You have to know what your living expenses are most likely to be and probably do some projection of that into the future, knowing that inflation is going to be a factor sooner or later and other issues. Now, what about the next number, what it needs to be? How big does it have to be? And I'm assuming that's the one where we look at what your income level has to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the easiest number to come up with. I mean, once you know what your budget is, you know, you're going to retire on $50,000 a year, 60, 70, 80, or 100, whatever that number is. Then what you do is you take that number and you subtract things that you know that are predictable. You know, maybe you have a pension or one spouse has a pension. You know what your Social Security is. And you subtract that from your expenses. And then what's left over is that's what you're going to have to provide through your investments, that shortfall. Then you know how much you're going to need to save. I mean, it's a simple mathematical calculation. You take what the rates of return are, and then you just back into it and say, well, if I need, let's say, $40,000 to come in or $30,000 to come in from my investments, you know, it's pretty easy to predict how much you're going to have by the time you retire. And the problem, John, as you referred to, in this zero interest rate environment that we operate now, returns aren't what most people thought they are. There are a lot of investors still sitting in cash and bonds, or even worse, gold. They're getting no cash flow. Their investments aren't big enough to provide the capital or build the amount of capital that they're going to need. We're in a low return environment. And a lot of people just simply aren't going to make their numbers. Others who are retired are finding themselves working part-time. They're going to have to downsize. I've come across several situations where we've had to redo, sell the house here in California, move to another state where the cost of living was much cheaper and free up some capital that was tied up in the equity of a home and also reduce tax rates and living expenses. But, you know, as far as knowing what that number is, it's really predicated, folks, on what your expenses are going to be in retirement. And then once you know that number, you just basically subtract the predictables, the pension, the Social Security, and you arrive at the shortfall. And that shortfall is pretty easy to calculate what kind of assets you're going to need to produce that kind of income.
So having talked about saving in a tax-efficient manner that gets you more dollars in your pocket and thereby more money to compound into earning for savings at retirement, you need a retirement budget. This tells you what you need to have saved up versus what you're going to have to be spending on a regular basis. But now what about retirement itself? Because there are always those unanticipated issues. We know that people are living longer, for example, so therefore the dollars have to last longer. This week's guest talks about medical expenses becoming a bigger burden in the future. You know, you could see a point whereby unforeseeable medical expenses could wipe out your retirement and your nest egg and even the house you're living in.
Yeah, I mean, most people, when they're thinking about retirement, they think, okay, retirement, it's kind of like an all-inclusive time period. Folks, you need to think about your retirement. We'll have 2 to 3 phases in it. Phase one could be pre-retirement, 5, 6, 8 years prior to your actual retirement date. Or it could be you retire early, let's say in your 40s or late 40s or 50s. I've had clients that have retired actually in their late 40s and some in their 50s, where you don't have access to your retirement programs without annuitizing or paying a penalty. So that's what we call phase one of retirement, and that's the pre-retirement phase or early retirement phase. Phase two is when you actually have access to your retirement funds without penalty, without annuitization. That begins at age 59 and a half. And then phase three is what we call full retirement availability for Social Security. And for most boomers out there right now, that's age 66. And what you really want to do is start thinking of your retirement in these phases, because phase one, either early retirement or getting ready for retirement, you're going to want to make your investments a little bit more conservative. Maybe you go from, you know, small cap stocks to large cap stocks, maybe add a fixed income component to your portfolio. And it's time to tone down the level of risk. And what I'm afraid of is so many people have been in cash or in bond funds that as this bull market continues, they're going to start rolling the dice in the final phase of the market when it starts to get crazy. If you retire early, consider, you know, maybe part-time work so you don't have to draw down as much on your assets. And if you can, defer tapping or drawing down your investments. The longer you allow them to accumulate, the bigger the nest egg that you're going to have that will last you longer in retirement, especially if you retire early. You have to make those dollars last a longer period of time. And what you're doing in pre-retirement, folks, you need to start thinking about what you're doing investment-wise. If you've been sitting in cash or everything's in a bond fund, that is not a wise choice. You know, with treasuries at 2.6% on a 10-year treasury note, how in the heck are you going to accumulate enough assets to last you 25, 30 years throughout your retirement years?
Okay, what about tapping into pensions and maybe Social Security? Now, those sources are a lot more predictable than investments, but when you're doing that, you also have to understand the rules that govern these various accounts. You have to know the penalties with pensions, IRAs at ages below 59 and a half years of age. What do you do so you don't have to access any of those plans before the appropriate age?
Well, I mean, if you retire early, consider working part-time to supplement your income. Because what you really want to do is avoid annuitization, which is a way that allows you to access your retirement funds early without paying the penalty. So we have found the best approach, John, has been to work part-time or get some kind of income. And you might be able to do something that you maybe wanted to do, something different than in your working career. The second phase is when you are at least 59 and a half, age 60, you now have access to your retirement funds at age 59 and a half. But you do have a 6-year gap between age 60 and 66, when you have full access to Social Security without any penalties. And really, you really want to wait to age 66 because you're going to pay a penalty if you take it early. And, you know, the longer you wait, the bigger those Social Security benefits get. And I can't tell you, folks, in this kind of low interest rate environment, how much equivalent additional assets that equates to. So at age 66, at that point, you could even work part-time and not worry about losing your Social Security benefits. You don't lose a dime like back in the old days when they used to phase it out. So once you reach age 66, full retirement age, that is the final stage. There are no drawbacks. At this stage, you need to think of increasing medical expenses that you're more likely to run into in your 70s, and you need to have investments. I don't care if it's rental real estate or blue chip stocks that are going to increase the income every single year, because how are you going to face those additional medical expenses, which we'll be even talking about now, that's been impacted by Obamacare, because your medical expenses are going to go up. In the final phase of retirement, you are likely to face one of two possible scenarios. Number one, higher medical expenses. Or number two, one of you ends up in a managed care facility. Now you're maintaining two households. You're maintaining a managed care where the sick spouse or the one that needs assisted care lives, and then the well spouse living in their home. So you need to have a growing source of income. And if you don't, you need to think about yourself, do you really want to start dipping into principal? What if one spouse gets sick, goes into a retirement home, you have no long-term care insurance, now you're drawing down principal to pay the expenses? Think of the condition that leaves the surviving spouse in. So you need to think of your retirement in three different phases, and you need to have an investment plan and financial plan to handle each one of those phases, because you're going to run into different expenses and a different environment.
You know, we started out by saying it's not that hard, but it's beginning to look a little harder than maybe it seemed at the beginning. How do you deal with all of these issues? I mean, when you're, say, for example, dealing with clients or working out a plan, there are a lot of issues here to confront. You have laws, you have taxes, markets, headline news, budgets, etc.
Well, I mean, fortunately, many of our clients we deal with, we start out with a financial plan. We have state-of-the-art software that lays out the probabilities of success. And the first thing you look at is, will they be successful? In other words, do they have enough assets given where their expenses are going to be, their lifestyle? And it's one of the first things we look at in the financial plan. There is a gauge. We run a Monte Carlo simulation that talks about, you know, scenarios with a bear market. What will that impact do to assets? Will there still be enough assets there? And it's kind of like, it's one of the first things I look at in a plan. It's kind of like a doctor. You go in for a physical, what's the doctor going to look at first? He's going to look at your blood work. And so, you know, if I see a 90% probability, I know that, you know, we're in pretty good shape asset-wise, expense-wise. If we're less than 90%, then we need to start thinking about alternatives. And John, everybody's a little bit different. A retirement plan has to fit the individual. They have to have the input. If you're suggesting something they're not comfortable with, well, it's not going to work. So the client has the largest input into the process. What we try to do is, when we don't have 90% probability of success, then we have to start thinking outside the box. We look at alternatives. And then we present those alternatives to the client, so the client could say, I don't like alternative A. That doesn't really work for us. Not comfortable with that. You know, maybe a combination of alternative B and C. So at the end of the day, the plan has to be the client's plan. It has to fit them personally. Otherwise, quite honestly, they're not going to implement it. It's not going to work. And there's so many ways you can solve a problem today. But more importantly, the individual has to be in charge of that process, because, you know, it's their plan, it's their life, it's their retirement. And, you know, really what our job is just to show them what the alternatives are.
Okay, let's put today's lesson perspective into action. Time to discuss the lesson with a case study. And to illustrate today's key concept, we'll talk about the two Johnsons. This is a real case study, but of course we've changed the names to protect the actual people.
Well, this is a case. Mike Johnson, age 55 when he came in to see us. His wife, Nancy, age 49. Mike was a marketing manager for a consumer products company. With the kids basically in college, Nancy worked in sales at Nordstrom. Two kids, sophomore in college and one a senior in high school. that was basically talking about going into the military. Their tax bracket was 33% federal and 7% state. So their combined tax bracket was about 40%. Now, they've done well. Mike makes a very good six-figure income in their assets, mainly $270,000 in cash. A lot of that had to come from liquidating assets during a market downturn and plus additional savings. Combination Mike's 401k with matching contributions at this point was about $800,000. IRAs between the two of them, close to $150,000. Their home was about $1.3 million. And Nancy had inherited $500,000 when her mom passed away. And so that was one of the reasons that kind of prompted the plan, because all of a sudden here was a big chunk of capital. So, I mean, they're in a pretty good situation. I mean, they had almost $3 million worth of assets with only about $400,000 worth of liabilities. Now, here was the plan, was to sell the home in New Jersey and retire at age 60 and buy one in Florida. And so the retirement plan was, when they came in to see us, they were about 5 years away from retirement, as many people on the East Coast do. You know, it's much easier to leave a high tax, high expense, high living area and go down to Florida where you have no income taxes. And when we went through the process, they took a look at, well, one of the things they planned on doing is taking some of the equity out of their home. And part of the plan was to go down to Florida, buy something for in the neighborhood of about $400,000. They could live in a really nice home, paid for, so no mortgage payments, free and clear. And their budget was roughly about $70,000 in fixed expenses, they figured, when they retired, and maybe $20,000 a year in travel expenses. So the real question was, would this work at age 60?
Well, it seems like with, you know, $3 million in assets, that would be more than adequate. But like many Americans, depending on what tax bracket you're in, you have a 40% tax rate. So at age 60, was that really a doable thing?
You know, if you take a look at age 55, they had close to, between Mike's 401k program, their IRAs, they had about $950,000 in pension. They got Nancy's $500,000 inheritance. And the idea was, when they sold their home in Florida, they've been down there, they vacationed down there, they thought they could live and find a house very comfortably for about $400,000, which would free up roughly about $500,000 of equity out of their home. So they'd have roughly $2 million of assets, $270,000, but remember, they're still working. And the problem is the $270,000 in assets was earning less than 1%. At least they had it in bank CDs rather than a money market fund. The second thing is their tax bracket was 40%. That was 33 federal, 7 state. And they were saving roughly about $40,000 a year. Now, part of that was going into Mike's 401k program, where he had matching contributions from the company. Now, it was assumed in the plan that the rate of return would be between 6 and 7%. So another 5 years of putting 40 grand a year away in savings, plus the accumulation of existing assets, they'd have roughly about $2.6 million when they retired, plus pulling out another $500,000 of equity out of their home when they sold that and then eventually moved down to Florida and pay cash. So at retirement, John, they were going to have a little over $3 million. So the plan was, in phase one, Mike was not using the extra accelerated contribution in his 401k program. Once you're over 50, you can put in a catch-up clause, an additional $5,000. So we urged him to add another $5,000 because it came right off the top of that $5,000. He was saving $2,000 in taxes just by doing that. The other thing is, with the cash and inheritance, we recommended blue chip dividend paying stocks because they were in a tax bracket where the dividends were going to be taxed at 15% versus 33% tax on interest. And so it was, you know, 40% of the tax rate. In the retirement assets, we wanted him to shift to roughly 70% blue chip type stocks with about 30% bonds. And we did that in his 401k program. Unfortunately, he couldn't do individual bonds, but we had short maturity bond funds to reduce some of the volatility, reduce some of the risk in the portfolio. And then with the personal assets, we mainly did dividend paying stocks because they were going to be taxed at 15%.
Let me interrupt you here for just a second, Jim. What about muni bonds? I mean, how come you didn't look at that? I mean, especially given his bracket.
Well, I mean, yeah, in a 40% bracket, the problem is, you know, with the munis in the area, we could only get 3% and that'd be going out 10 years. It just didn't look attractive. You know, we could get over 3% in dividend paying stocks taxed at only 15%. Heck, I could get utilities, master limited partnerships, royalty trust, and make a lot more money after tax and have that source grow. Because remember, what we wanted to do to make this plan work is accumulate as much assets as we could at the time of retirement, because we had the second phase of their retirement, which was going to be between age 60 and 66 when they could start tapping into Social Security. The other thing that we talked to them about, I go, look, real estate market's going very well. You don't need the big house now. You may want to consider in the next couple of years selling the house, buying the house in Florida right now or in the next couple of years, pay cash for it, turn it into a rental to earn some extra income, which you can shelter with depreciation until you get to retirement. Because I don't know 5 years from now if the real estate market is going to be where it is today. And everybody recalls what happened to real estate between 2007 and 2011. So part of the plan was to sell the big house that they're living in now a couple of years prior to retirement. Now, phase two was to move to Florida, where they would save immediately 7% in state income taxes. They would drop to a 15% tax rate at retirement, not only on dividends, but also on the personal income they could tap into in their IRA. And the dividends would be taxed at 15%. Phase three was at age 66 when Mike's Social Security would kick in, which was going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $26,000, $27,000. And then eventually, a couple years later, Nancy would be getting her Social Security. So, I mean, this was really a good plan. But what we were doing is setting the plan in place 5 years prior to retirement, getting the ducks in the row, minimizing taxes, accelerating some of the money put into the 401k program, making the investment income taxed at 15% versus 30%, and then also probably putting the house up for sale a couple of years prior to the move down to Florida, lock in the price of the home, pay cash for it, maybe turn it into a rental. But here, what we were doing, John, is making his investment income tax efficient and putting in place a plan so maybe he doesn't make it to age 60. You know, maybe the company downsizes, we go into a recession. But we had a plan in place for each phase of their retirement where we'd have access or tap into different sources of income. The IRA at age 60 and then Social Security at age 66.
So what you did here was you took into account all three phases of retirement planning. You moved his investment income from a 30% to a 15% bracket. Also, a greater deduction on the taxes by moving more money into a 401k plan. So it looked like you moved right into phase one of retirement pretty smoothly.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing about having a plan, because we had structures in place, we had a plan, we were taking advantage of lowering their taxes, and then on top of that, you know, we were putting a plan in motion. So there was step one, step two, and they also knew that, okay, when they retire, which would be phase two at age 60, they knew exactly where their income was going to come from, they knew where they were going to live, they would have a house, they would take the equity out of their existing house, that would be working for them, and then, of course, at age 66, they would have access to Mike's Social Security, and 4 years later to Nancy's Social Security, you know, when Mike got close to age 70. So those additional expenses that you might anticipate in phase three of retirement, medical expenses or long-term care, there was ample assets and income to take care of each one of those phases.
And Jim, if people would like more information or contact you about retirement planning, there must be a number at which they can do that.
If you would like to put together your retirement plan, you can reach us at 888-486-3939, and we can talk to you about putting together your own personal retirement plan.
And coming up next, Jim will be interviewing Patrick Flynn on the perils and trials of the Affordable Health Care Act for people who may have lost coverage, have higher coverage, or, well, we don't know what the issue might be, but that's what the interview is all about. Coming up next, as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
Well, ever since Obamacare got put into practice, there's been a lot of confusion in the medical marketplace. Individuals and millions of families have lost coverage. Does Medicare Advantage still work? What kind of policy should you have? And what is it going to cost you? Joining me as my special guest on the program today is Patrick Flynn. He's president of West Coast Benefits. And Patrick, I know that in our own case as a company, last year I was told that our premiums are going to go up about 5%, but I have no idea what it could be a year from now, depending on what was implemented in Obamacare. So why don't we take our listeners through what has changed in the medical marketplace now that we, like it or not, we're stuck with Obamacare unless they change it?
I think it kind of breaks down the categories. You know, it's an individual looking for coverage, a company looking for coverage, or an organization. And for individuals, there's been a lot of change. And, you know, ever since the law on pay or play, and, you know, if you don't have coverage, you're going to now pay 2% up to $325. You know, it's forcing people, if you will, to go to the market to get coverage. But if they didn't do it in a timely manner, you don't have coverage and you have to wait for open enrollment, which is kind of like Medicare. You have to wait, I think it's November 15th, and you have from then until January to get on effective January. And you can do that through your website. You can do that through the help of a broker, however you want. But individuals have to be more active in getting coverage for themselves. And that's not easy, not just in California, but on some other states because of problems with technology.
Are you referring, Patrick, here to the website? Because I know when it was first launched, you know, people didn't know if they had coverage. They didn't know who was paying. So if you have to go on, let's say, the government site during the open enrollment period, is part of the problem the technology of it not really fully working yet?
That's part of it. And the other part is I think people don't understand the questions correctly and may answer them wrong. My suggestion is you should have a professional, you know, if you're doing this, let someone help you, let a professional help you that knows how to navigate the website so you get what you need. But I don't know that getting what you need is really possible anymore because they've created these plans. They're called metal plans, and, you know, it's from bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. But most of the plans that are coming out of not just the Covered California website, but comparable websites, the coverages are not as good as what most people have. The deductible, I think the average deductible is now $1,200. And if you think back, you know, to your medical plan that you probably have a $250 to $500 deductible, but these plans are much higher. Their out-of-pocket maximum costs are higher as well, which can be from, you know, as low as $3,000, but most of them are $5,000 to $6,000. And the networks of physicians have changed. A lot of people, just because it's Blue Cross, think you have access to all of Blue Cross PPO doctors, and a lot of the networks are slim, or what I call skinny. They're not the full network, and in some cases, they're very, very small. So, you know, there's a lot of changes, and we haven't seen the affordability part of this yet. You know, the law says, you know, it's supposed to be affordable, and most plans have gone up significantly and continue to go up significantly. So I'm waiting for that affordability, and not just me, I think our clients are waiting for that as well, but it doesn't look like it's on the horizon.
Yeah, because I know that part of the plan is it's almost like a one-size-fits-all that, for example, if you're 60 years old and you're working at a company, you have to have pregnancy coverage included in your plan, or maybe you have to have drug coverage. So it's kind of like what I call redistribution of health benefits, because if you don't need pregnancy coverage, because that is, I know as an employer, when you have, let's say, families that work for you that are young families starting out, you usually include that in your plan, but you don't need that for the older employees. It's my understanding a lot of this stuff gets thrown into these policies now, and as you know, an insurance company has to price that in.
Right. Well, I think it's not just that. It's the taxing as well, because there's 21 or 22 different taxes that came with these bills, including taxing the actual premium on the health care, taxing the number of employees. There's also capital gains taxes changed. Medical devices have now increased the cost. So there's a myriad of things that went in the bill that are really taxes, fees, call them what you'd like, to try to pay for all of this. And it's still out to lunch, I think, the actuarially, whether it is going to pay for this or whether it's not. You know, my personal opinion was we could expanded Medicaid and Medi-Cal and done this much easier.
But the law is here, and there's been, I know, a lot of exemptions to this case. I mean, how do you keep up with it, and how do you know? Let's take two situations. Let's take an individual that doesn't have insurance. Okay, we know now under pay or play, you either get on these health exchanges or get your insurance, or you're going to have to pay a tax, which we know goes up gradually every single year.
Right.
So let's take an individual that doesn't have insurance. What does that individual do? Do you go on the exchanges?
Well, actually, right now, you can't. Like I said before, it's kind of like Medicare when, you know, you can get on at a certain time of year. Now, we did have the open enrollment period extended last year kind of for the kickoffs, and it was really a four-month period. And they even in March went back and allowed some people that had problems to go on again. I don't know if that's going to happen this year, but on a go-forward basis, it's basically you're going to sign up in November, December for an effective January. And if you don't have insurance currently, let's say right now you don't have insurance, you can't get it for today. You know, it's going to be delayed. And so that was, I think, a big surprise to a lot of people who thought at any time during the year they could have access to this and get coverage, and that's not true.
Patrick, let's say that you don't want to go on the government site for insurance. Can you go to like Blue Cross on your own or an independent insurance company, or are you forced to go through the government?
No, you're not forced. You can go through a carrier, you can go through a broker, and there are private exchanges as well. And the private exchanges are probably the biggest growing thing in the future will be the private exchanges, not the government exchanges. So you have that option.
And what about the expense? Because isn't there like a standard type of policy to qualify or not pay a fine? You have to have certain things included in your policy?
That's correct. And they've broken it down really into what they consider these four metal plans, which are the gold, silver, bronze, and platinum type plans. But they basically rate the plans, and you can do that or have someone do it for you to see, you know, what it is. But it's basically, you know, platinum plan having a greater coverage or more comprehensive coverage than the bronze. But you do legally need to have the bronze plan or benefits like the bronze plan, or it, you know, you're considered not to have health insurance. So it has to pass the litmus test, so to speak.
So if, let's say I'm 60 years old and I don't want to have pregnancy coverage, but when I go out, I'm going to have to buy a policy that includes that.
Correct.
That can't help but drive the cost of insurance up. As you mentioned, I've read stories, and you know more about this than I do, where in many cases, people are finding that their coverage is double, that the deductible, as you mentioned, may be 2 to 3 times higher than what they had in a previous plan. I know that when we originally had plans, our deductibles were like $250.
Right.
They're much higher today.
No, that's common. That is absolutely common. Most of these plans have much larger deductibles than people are used to. They also have out-of-pocket expenses that people aren't used to. This past year, one of the changes was they were going to allow all of the deductibles and the coinsurance to be part of the out-of-pocket maximum, the most that you can pay in any calendar year plan. That's what the maximum out-of-pocket would, and then the carrier would pick up anything beyond that. And typically, you know, policies would have 2,500 to 3,000 maximum out of pocket. And today, these metal plans are more like $5,000, $6,000, and $7,000 out of pocket. So there is a lot more expense being transitioned to the individual and not to the insurance carrier. So they're responsible for a lot more in all of these plans.
So in many ways, I don't know where they get these statistics that healthcare costs have come down. How can they have come down if I have to go out and buy a policy that has, number one, a greater deductible, two, is going to cost me more because I have to buy benefits I don't even need?
And three, is going to probably have a physician network and hospital network that is less than what you've been used to.
So is there any way to get around that? Can I get a policy like the way it used to work before Obamacare?
No, you know, they did extend some of them saying, you know, at first they said, you know, you had to make a change by such and such date, and then they've rolled that back. But even with rolling that back, some of the carriers weren't able to do it because they already made the changes that the ACA demanded. And then when they gave relief, transitional relief is what they termed it, the carriers had already made the changes and they couldn't go back and recreate the plans that they no longer were supposed to have. So some of the problems have been the ACA laws invoke the carriers to do certain things, and then if you change your mind, they don't realize that the carriers can't make these changes overnight. You know, they have millions and millions of insureds, and it's just virtually impossible, and some have chosen not to do it. Another example is the out-of-pocket expense that they tried to roll, the deductibles and the coinsurance. Well, coinsurance is always part of your maximum out-of-pocket, but the actual copays and your deductible usually weren't. The original law said that we had to include all copays and deductibles. And a lot of companies, when it comes to prescription drugs, that you use a different vendor on the prescription drugs than you do the medical plan. And so how does one company speak to another company in order to produce these maximums? And there's also problems with your trading information from one vendor to another. That's private medical information where legally you're really not allowed to do that. So part of the problem, I think, is that the individuals that are setting these laws really don't practice. And so you get 62-year-old person that needs to get maternity coverage and things like that. So it's just not a good fit for a lot of people. And the pricing, I mean, I don't see that coming down at all. And I think most professionals in the industry would tell you the same thing.
And, you know, not only that, but let's say the number of individuals are now given coverage that's subsidized by government. What about in terms of the cost of healthcare going up because of that? Because it seems like it overstresses the system. I didn't see any preparation in advance where they were going to graduate more nurses and more doctors. I mean, even, you know, I go through scripts here locally, and my doctor's office called me 6 months in advance of my annual physical just to make sure I had an appointment.
Yeah, that's another problem. There is just a wicked shortage of primary care physicians, physician assistants. And some of the changes you're going to see that are happening, and to some degree have already happened in that, are some of the carriers right now, you can have an online visit, if you will. And if you have an iPhone and, you know, you think you have a sore throat, you can take a picture of your throat, and they're going to diagnose you and possibly prescribe medication for something that you have. You're going to see a lot more primary care docs on what they used to do as a physician, maybe pass on a lot of that to physician assistants. And then we have the doc in the boxes, which is the acronym for, you know, you go to Target and they're going to have a doctor that can give you flu shots, you know, take your temperature, see if you have a fever, and, you know, minor kind of things that people would sometimes be going to either the emergency room for or urgent care rooms to offset the cost. So I think medicine a few years from now is going to look a lot different than it does right now. And there's just a large amount of stress, if you will, on the system because there aren't enough primary care docs to handle the increase, if you will, in all of the insureds. And that was a problem from day one, and no one's really addressed it. So these supplements, I'd call them, you know, of online visits and going to a doc in the box will help, but it remains to be seen how effective it is. And currently, I don't see any decrease in the people that are going to the urgent care centers or the emergency rooms. And even though that was one of the biggest reasons, supposedly, for doing this, it hasn't changed. I mean, we don't see any change in the population or the amount of population that's going to the emergency rooms.
Is there any way, Patrick, for an individual to mitigate or get a better policy, or is it pretty much you're stuck with the three plans, gold, bronze, or silver?
Yes, you can. I mean, obviously, on the group side, absolutely you can. On the individual side, I'm going to say that's getting harder and harder. Maybe through the private exchanges, the answer to that is yes. Through the government exchanges, the answer to that is no. You're going to get the bare minimum, if you will, on the metal plans. So there still are ways to get better coverage. And most people that are in group plans do have more comprehensive coverage than an individual would have available to them. And again, the only exception to that would be on the private exchanges where, you know, they may have metal plans as well, but they'll have additional plans. So if you want a more comprehensive plan, you have the availability to do that.
But the net on this for the individual, he's going to end up paying, in many cases, as much as twice as much had he had a regular policy. The deductibles are going to be much greater. So this is going to represent a significant cut in an average person's pocketbook.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. And the scary thing, you know, I know there's been a lot of changes since, you know, we first started with this, and it seems every week, you know, you're looking at, okay, what did they change this week? And one of the things to be cognizant of, which in 2018 is the Cadillac tax. And I think that'll be the demise of our medical system. Because what the Cadillac tax does is they're going to take a plan, and I believe they already measured this. They are going to take a plan and say that if your plan has a greater cost than X, and let's call X $10,000. If your plan has a greater cost than X because it's more comprehensive than one of the metal plans, and let's just choose the silver plan because I believe that's what it will be. So if, let's say, your plan costs $14,000 because it has better coverages, lower deductibles, lower out-of-pocket maximums, then you are going to be taxed 40% of that $4,000, what's above what's considered, you know, a reasonable a level of coverage, which to me is the most ridiculous part of this entire law, that, you know, if someone's willing to pay more for the coverage because they want better coverage, you know, you're going to treat them as if they literally have platinum. You know, they're getting something back for this, you know, and it's someone that just wants more comprehensive health care, and particularly for people with chronic diseases, you know, that's a lot of money to charge someone for trying to protect themselves from illness.
Wow. Let's move on to something that maybe even looks better, and that's the group plans. I know there's some controversy there in terms of which companies have to have what. If you have 50 employees or under, a lot of companies have cut back on employment so they don't have to get covered. There's fines. So what's going on with group coverage? And you mentioned earlier that group coverage is a little bit more favorable, your options, your choices, etc. Let's talk about that. What separates that out and what can companies do?
Well, there's kind of two categories they've divided, and you mentioned that on the small group, you know, if you have 50 employees, and that doesn't mean you actually have 50 employees. They have a definition for an employee equivalent, but, you know, when you do the math, if you fall in that category of small group, which is under 50, then you do not have to offer. There is no penalty, pay or play and such. But if you do offer plans, they do have to meet at least the litmus test of the bronze plan. And the carriers that are trying to comply with this are all basically just coming out with plans that meet, you know, the silver, gold, platinum, and bronze. So there is going to be less of a choice of plans in the small group neighborhood, if you will, in the future, particularly in California.
Okay, so you've got maybe a little better coverage, a little better choice if you're in a company plan, at least for the moment, and who knows, as you mentioned, they almost every week seems like something's changing. Let's move on to Medicare, because a lot of seniors who enroll in Medicare choose to go with Medicare Advantage. How has that been affected with Obamacare?
I'd say the, you know, number one thing is pricing, and again, because even those plans are defined on, you know, what has to be covered. And so the supplemental or the Advantage type plans, I think you're going to see the rates going up on those because of those things.
You know, if you're a 70-year-old senior female, do you have to buy pregnancy coverage?
Unfortunately, you can't restrict it and say it's not covered. So, yes.
So, you've got to include more things. And as we know, it's like anything else in insurance. The more things that are included that the insurance company is at risk to pay for, that's got to be reflected somewhere in the premium.
You're right. You're 100% correct. And here's one of the problems I see, and I think will be in the area of cost, is when you have private medical insurance, just to give you an example of kind of what a hospital situation, if a procedure costs $10,000, that's what the hospital charges. Most carriers discount, just to give you an idea, are going to be somewhere around 50% to 60%. So the net cost is really going to be $5,000 or $6,000 that the insurance company will pay. Well, if you want to take a look at Medicare, so that same $10,000, the Medicare is paying $2,500 to $3,000. That's the difference. So that's what they're spending for the docs and the hospitals, period. It's almost 25 or 35% of the bill, and it's almost twice as much, twice as effective, if you will, than the carriers. So the more you move individuals from private plans to government plans, if you will, that shift means there's more and more people, more and more doctors going to have to take that lower amount. I mean, we're talking, you know, 25 to 30% of the actual bill charges, as opposed to their, you know, typically used from a carrier getting 50 to 60%. Well, the more that happens, you know, there's only one thing for the rates to do. if you're not subsidized by the private industry, which is the case today, you know, the reason Medicare can charge as little as they can is because the docs and the hospitals pass off the additional coverage to private plans. Well, when there's less and less private plans, that's just going to mean the costs are going to increase, including and especially on Medicare.
It almost seems like this whole thing was designed eventually, because the way it's structured, to move everybody into a government program.
You know, I have that fear that, you know, this was just the step, and a lot of people have that same fear to move us into a government or a one-payer system. I hope that doesn't happen, because I think our system, even though we have faults, I'm not sure that Obamacare was the answer to the faults, and I think most people would agree with that. There were much easier ways to insure more people through Medi-Cal and Medicaid, and that was done to a degree, and then I think the rest of what's done has really been a tax plan, not so much a health plan.
So, given the industry and what you see coming, do you see any resolution or any possibility that some of this will be rolled out, or let's say changed and made, let's say, cheaper, more affordable, or are we pretty much stuck with this in the politicians? Because there's been attempts to repeal it. It's gone nowhere, and it's going to go nowhere as long as the president is president. I mean, he's not going to get rid of his signature legislation. But are there any talk, or are you hearing anything that, hey, there's a better way to go about this, we can fix this, and we can make it better?
There's a lot of talk about that, and there's been some significant changes made already, because individuals that made the changes really weren't in the industry and didn't realize some of the repercussions of some of the things they've done. You know, like I explained before about the prescription drugs copays being part of the maximum out-of-pocket. Well, if it's a different carrier, how can you mandate that? You really can't, even though they did. They actually mandated something that was illegal because of the private medical information. Even an insurance company doesn't have a right to give that to another company. So there have been some changes. I think we're going to see additional changes. I hope we don't come up with a model, you know, a Canadian model. You know, if you look at all of our hospitals in Canadian border in the United States, they're filled with Canadians. And so if those type plans work so well, why are they all coming to our hospitals? So I think we can make changes that make sense, and a lot of Obamacare really doesn't, and is putting a burden on employers. I mean, employers now, the large employers have to produce this new 6056 tax form every year and determine who has coverage, who doesn't have coverage. You know, there's a lot pushed off to the employer on this, and, you know, from a pure standpoint of cost, if, you know, employer plans are subsidizing the government plans, and you then reduce all of the employer plans, you're just increasing the cost for everyone or decreasing the coverage or some combination. And I believe really Obamacare has done that. It has increased the out-of-pocket expenses for the average individual by reducing the coverage amounts. And now by creating a coverage amount, saying that if you have coverage that is better than this, that we're going to tax you 40% on the Cadillac tax. Well, that's just preposterous. I mean, I think there'd be a revolution before we see that enacted.
Do you think, maybe not in the next couple of years, until, let's say, we get into the next presidential cycle, that as more and more people see, either one, they've lost their insurance, two, they're forced into getting insurance policies that are twice as expensive, the deductibles are two or three times more expensive, that I can't help but think that, Patrick, that's going to be reflected at the voting booth somewhere?
I'm sure it will, and it's taken time, but a lot of people have felt that, and the next year a lot more people will feel that. And one of the things that I don't think is publicized enough is that the subsidies that are given out were only for 2 years. We don't know what's going to happen at the end of 2 years. And, you know, if I didn't have insurance before, but I now have it because I have a subsidy that's paying me $800 a month, well, when that $800 a month goes away, that subsidy, where are we going to be? So I think some dramatic changes are going to have to happen in the next couple of years.
Let's boil this down to three particular individuals and just a quick snippet in terms of advice. You're an individual. What advice would you give an individual right now?
My advice would be to go to a professional, you know, either broker or consultant that can shop for you, not just on the government plans, but on the private plans as well, to see what really benefits you. You know, what's the best product for you at this time? That would be my advice for an individual.
And for companies?
I'm going to break that down on the small group versus large group. On small group, it isn't mandated yet, so you don't have to do anything. But if you do, you're pretty much going to be forced into the metal plans unless you go to the private exchange where you have bigger options. And I think those options are worth looking at because the one-size-fits-all really doesn't work, and it doesn't work in a small group policy either, but that's kind of what they've created. On a large group above 50, most employers, you know, are using a consultant or a broker to help them, you know, make a selection that's best for them. But still, you know, you're going to see pricing increases. You know, this year they say the average pricing increase has been around 8%. But that, you know, depends on who you ask. And you ask the government, they're saying medical costs went up 3%. You're looking at insurance premiums, and they've gone up on average of 8%. So I guess it depends where you're getting your information, what stat really is true. But our average increase for our clients we've seen this year to be probably in the 7% to 8% range, which, although is less than it was years ago, it's still higher than, you know, what inflation is, and it's been higher than inflation for a long, long time.
And then finally, let's take somebody, a senior that may be on Medicare Advantage plan. What do you advise them?
Yeah, it's worth looking at other plans, shopping that supplemental plan each year if you want. Also, if you're pharmacy, which is really important, I think, on those plans particularly, you may, over the course of the year, or your spouse may have started taking medication that doesn't have as much coverage or is more costly. And so if you can go to a professional that has access to that information where, you know, you can tell me what medications you take, we can put it into the system and tell you what your costs are going to be for that plan. And that is important on Medicare because there's so much utilization of pharmacy, and the cost differentials can be significant, even if you have access to certain medications or not. So it's worth looking at least every couple of years, but I'd say if you had any changes in your medications in the past year, you should look at what other options are available that may provide more coverage.
And finally, Patrick, given how messed up this is and the increase in cost, as you mentioned, as a small business, the 8% figure is closer to what we've been experiencing. Are you optimistic that at least some kind of relief or reprieve will come through the voting booth in the years ahead?
It has to. I mean, I don't know how the public could just take this over and over again and get increased in premiums and decreased in coverage. You can only do that for so many years before, you know, people are going to rebel. And that's pretty much what we've had for the last few years since Obamacare started. No one has seen where the affordability is unless it's with a subsidy. Well, it's easy to create government subsidies, but, you know, is that something that we can do on a go-forward basis? You know, can everyone be on subsidies? Can the plan really afford that? You know, I don't know the answer to that. But I know, you know, when the subsidies go away, a lot of people that are covered will no longer be covered, and we'll kind of be back to ground zero.
Mm. Well, listen, Patrick, as we close, if our listeners would like to contact you or the services your firm offers, how could they do so, please?
Yeah, West Coast Group Benefits. You can reach us at 858-521-0025, or we have a website at westcoastbenefits.com.
Well, Patrick, listen, thanks for joining us on Lifetime Income. Very insightful. Yeah, there's a lot going on here that I think many people gradually over time are going to be exposed to, whether they like it or not. Thanks so much, and please come back and talk to us again.
I will. Thank you, Jim.
You know, it was interesting that Patrick Flynn was talking about the mess that this is in, which really shouldn't surprise us, Jim. Remember, we followed this through back in, what was it, 2008, when they put this thing through. And the goal of the party, the Democrats at the time, to put this through was simply to get the football across the goal line. And as Nancy Pelosi said, well, we have to pass this bill so we can find out what's in it. Well, now we're finding out that it's a patchwork quilt of things, and it's such a mess. The real question is, given another couple of years, we get to 2016, is there going to be some kind of a voter revolt and they either just repeal the whole thing, which is really, I don't know, governments rarely ever do that. Congresses and parliaments rarely ever do that. Or whether they're going to try a serious reform of this or put in place what we really needed. We needed healthcare reform, not another whole new system that we could try, which, as you notice, has got really inbuilt issues. But anyway, once again, if people want to talk to you about lifetime income planning or obtain your services on that, what's the number to do so?
We have a toll-free number, 888-486-3939, and we'd be glad to work with you on developing your own retirement plan. And remember, folks, that this isn't difficult. The key is really getting focused and thinking about your retirement and coming up with a roadmap. You'd never think of leaving your house, going on a trip or a road trip without a GPS system in your car or, let's say, a Google map that's going to tell you what road to get there. It's the same thing when it comes to retirement. Well, speaking of time, we've run out of time again. So on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.